Hello and welcome to Scriptmate, the podcast for writers who dream of seeing their words spoken by paid actors on some sort of screen. I'm your host, Tim Schulberger, writer and founder of Write LA, a writing community and writing education and resources site. You're staring at me. It's weird. Joining me is the highly skilled and questionably opinionated writer, Tony Giambuso. Hello, Tony.
Hello, Tim.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. The last episode was cool.
It was good. Yeah. I'm really excited to get the feedback on it.
Yeah. Yeah. From your mum and mine. Yeah. In this episode, Tony and I are going to answer big, important questions about writing and the state of play for those yet to break through with a credit, I think. I mean, you're going to ask me. Things like the future of script competitions and what are some of the more annoying aspects of this ridiculous craft that consumes so much of our waking hours and dreams. I wrote that. We'll also pick some movie moments that mean something to us, and I'll share some random Aussie trivia. But first, questions, Tony.
Yeah, so went through some listener questions and kind of tried to glean some you know, consistent queries. And so I just kind of wrote down some, paraphrased some things that maybe we can talk about that the people want to know.
It's a very long intro.
And then also things that I care about as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, one major thing was this idea, and it's something that I also think about a lot, which is what the hell do I write next?
Right.
Like I wrote my script. It's good. It's out there. It's doing its thing. People like it.
Or it sucked.
But like, I don't need to go and work on that script. I need to do something different or I need to do a new thing. What do I do next?
Well, I will say that every literary manager I've spoken to, when I send them, because as part of the prize, the main prize for Write LA is that you get read by literary managers, mm-hmm. right? And we had a winner a few years ago who wrote hands down the best script, and all the literary managers wanted to have a meeting with her, and she had no other script, and none of the literary managers signed her because they were like, look, she's done an awesome job with this script, but we don't know whether we can build a career for her because we don't know what else she's got in the tank. And so this is my way of saying, because I see some scripts sometimes that get entered into the competition like 5 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you kind of have to leave it behind if that's the only project you're working on. So as much as your question is, what do I write next? I suppose I'm adding saying, you need to write next.
Mm-hmm.
You should have another script, another string to your bow, because when you if and when you get that meeting and you get that access, they're going to want to know what else you got.
Yeah, so I feel like that's the big question though, right? It's like, yes, definitely write more. Never stop writing. Always be writing.
Never stop.
And sometimes, you know, I've had, and I've mentioned this before, I've had scripts that I wrote 10 years ago that I did, you know, 100 rounds of notes on, like you said, enter the contest 5 times, do all the things, and then just put it away, just said, I'm never touching this again. And then 5 years later, I wake up in a cold sweat and realize I have like an angle on it or something. And then it becomes something because I just needed those 5 years in between. But I've written, you know, several other things in that time.
Right.
But I feel like, you know, say I've written my rom-com and it's out there and I've written my second and third rom-com and now I'm thinking, what do I do next? Like that feeling of wanting to game the system, saying, what's being sold right now? What are people looking for? What are people not looking for? How do I tailor my script to be perfect for the market? And then having that feeling of, no, I should write something that I care about. But then I think, what do I care about? I don't know what I care about anymore. Like, do I have any feelings?
I don't care.
and are those relevant in that sort of just imposter syndrome and all those things that come with it? And so that's sort of just that slew of emotions that I pretty much constantly feel all the time.
Okay. And the question in
fix
there,
it for me.
Right. I'm not a therapist yet working on it.
Yeah.
I think it's simple, actually. I think the answer to this question is simple.
Okay.
That I've learned over my these many years. I feel that you need to write, or that my suggestion would be that you write something that speaks to where your head's at right now. Like what interests you on an emotional level. Because if we are human beings who are relatively self-aware, we are going through life, and life is sort of like, I'm seeing now, life is a series of chapters. Could be long chapter, could be short chapter, whatever. But you're constantly evolving as a human being. I know we're getting a bit heavy for a writing podcast, but you are evolving as a human being, which means there's a very good chance that something that consumed you when you were 23 on an emotional level is not going to consume you when you're 33. Mm-hmm. You will have moved on. You'll be thinking about other things. There'll be different things in your head about, you know, maybe different anxieties or different things that resonate with you on an emotional level. So my advice would be have a bit of a listen to you in terms of what's resonating on an emotional level. Like maybe there's a movie, like I went to see Superman yesterday, and the only parts that really resonated with me on an emotional level were Clark and Lois mm-hmm. trying to figure out their relationship.
Yeah, they're great. Those are the best scenes in the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And they were the ones that really felt, because you could see them both sort of fumbling around. Now, mm-hmm. likewise, there was a whole bunch of dog in that movie. Mm-hmm. So clearly James Gunn loves dogs and might have a particular dog at the moment that is meaningful to him or a relationship with his dog. And he's like, I'm going to put the dog in there. But in 5 years ago, he may not have given a crap about dogs. Mm-hmm. So it's really about, I think it's about really taking stock of you, taking a moment to be like, okay, where am I in life? What stories am I being drawn to? What movies do I want to watch on Netflix? Or what am I like, am I in a rom-com? You know, and what particular type of rom-com? Just what's going on? And then from there, it'd be like, okay, I'm right now, because you need a theme, mm-hmm. your script's going to need some sort of subtext. And it's going to be, as I say to people, every piece of art is examining some aspect of the human condition. So it's really thinking about what aspect of the human condition is kind of doing it for you right now, because it wouldn't have been, it's unlikely it would be doing it for you. It would have been doing it for you 5 years ago. It's unlikely it will be doing it for you in 5 years' time. It's where you are right now.
So it sounds like what I need to do,
yes.
and also dear listeners, take a beat. Don't worry about, I mean, yes, you need to be writing soon, but don't worry about coming up with the perfect idea right away. Take some stock about what you care about, what interests you.
Right now.
Right now, what itch you're trying to scratch, what story you're trying to tell, even if it's a small little idea that you can grow into something else. You know, for me, sometimes some people try to have, you know, kind of the whole story mapped out before they start writing. I think maybe the state that I'm in right now is just needing to follow those little breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
And then without knowing what the story is or even what the major theme is, and then going, oh, I keep talking about X. Well, maybe I should just write about that.
Right.
And sometimes maybe the more difficult things.
Or at least think about, why do I keep thinking
exactly,
about
yeah.
that? Why does that thing keep popping into my head?
Okay.
Because there's something there. There's obviously something there. My brain is telling me mm-hmm. I should listen to what my brain is trying to tell me.
And that will create that emotional connection that we talked about in our last episode
exactly.
with Felicity about that thing that resonates with us that can resonate with the person reading it.
Exactly. If you can't find, I would argue that that's what I've learned. I would argue that is the starting point for a script versus the how do I wedge in an aspect of the human condition into this cool idea I've had. Likewise, going backwards into your archive, like I've wrote down a whole bunch of really good ideas and I love these ideas. How do I make a movie out of them? If you're trying to force that at this point, it's like, I know this is a good idea and other people tell me. Like my story about the guy who I've been fiddling around with this story for years about this guy who has a week. He has some medical condition. He's going to die in a week unless he cries and he can't cry. He can't make himself cry. I keep talking about it. I keep thinking about it. I can't find a way to make a script that's compelling enough for me, let alone anybody else. So, but for me to visit, and that might just be that at a particular moment, I felt something and I don't feel that now. Mm-hmm. And I'm having trouble getting into that emotional space. So you don't have to go back and say, oh, I wrote down all these really good ideas that I said one day I'm going to go back and work on it. Maybe not. It just might be just because, again, I keep saying we're constantly evolving. And so listening to that evolution means right now, something's going to be really meaningful to you and you're going to be able to explore it in a way that you haven't been able to do before and you won't be able to do again. So take advantage of that because that will give you the emotional authenticity.
And then maybe you can, once you find that thing, you can mine all those other ideas for the
Absolutely.
Cool stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And rip off other stuff going on. But, you know, you might have a life change. You might have had a kid or you've got your kids in going to school or you just got divorced or you just got married or you just met a woman or you just broke up with a woman. I mean, there's stuff going on all the time. Even if it's a sci-fi. I mean, sci-fi movies still have that like sense of loss or sense of, you know, finding someone or sense of, I mean, it's all still built into a story and into a genre that you like. It's just finding that core first and then building out.
Great. Asked and answered.
All right.
Next question. Some people wanted to ask about Coverfly closing. Coverfly is, talk about what it is and your thoughts on it.
Yes. Let's. I if you are new to this podcast, welcome. Write LA is many things, but one of them is a screenwriting competition, and we've been going for 9 years. It'll be our ninth season next time. The constant battle is getting writers to enter the competition and finding places for them that you can find writers in order to encourage them to enter your competition. Coverfly began as Screencraft, which was a slew of screenwriting competitions, and they went trying to find a good writer, they did it genre by genre.
Mm-hmm.
So we can try to find, you know, enter your drama script or your rom-com, and they're all separate competitions. They did very well, surprisingly so, and then created Coverfly, which was sort of this like landing place where you would create a profile, you would upload your scripts, you would write your log lines, and then theoretically industry people could stumble upon them if they wanted, or you could enter a bunch of competitions through their site just by an easy click. You don't have to go to each individual website. You can just find a bunch. And they, at the time, they were curating competitions, so they were sort of saying that all the competitions on Coverfly were more legit, because we all know there are a bunch of dodgy ones. And they did very well. And they made, and they grew, and they have 127,000 writers on their email list. And they, Write LA has been, they've been hosting me for, what, I don't know, 4 years, 4 or 5 years now. Yeah. And we get a substantial number of entries from that site. A few years ago, they got sold by the original owners to Cast and Crew, which is the people who also own Final Draft, and they also do a lot of accounting for production. Cast and Crew have made the decision to close down Coverfly starting August the 1st. So
it's my birthday.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, happy birthday. Coverfly goes away. So this sort of place that held, that was like a little community for 127,000 writers, is about to disappear altogether. They're not moving somewhere else. They're not doing anything else. They're
That's what I'm doing to celebrate.
Yeah. You'll be disappearing forever. Yeah, good. Not forever. Just disappear for the day. So what do we do? And so that's caused a bit of a ripple through the screenwriting competition scene. I'm quite friendly with the people who run the Page Awards. We've been having many conversations about it, about like, holy crap, what does this mean?
Yeah.
And at the same time, the Nichols Fellowship, which was the beacon of screenwriting competitions, it's run by the Academy. If you haven't entered it, probably too late.
Yeah.
But they were, it was a nonprofit, it was a branch of the Academy. So if you did well in that competition, you really felt like you were part of the system. You're, you know, one step away from an Academy Award. They've launched a few careers. They've gotten notice. They have announced that they're handing over all the entries and the first round of reading to the Blacklist, which is a less reputable organization than the Nichols Fellowship. So we can have a whole conversation about why I think the Blacklist is not as reputable, but the reality is they charge money for a monthly hosting of a script. I wouldn't recommend anybody do that because it's just money for nothing. The fact that Nichol is now using Blacklist and that Coverfly is going away gives this impression that screenplay competitions might be dying. Nichols is certainly the pinnacle, and for them to fall over and sort of align themselves in this way has been confronting. Coverfly disappearing is also confronting. I am, as for my feelings about the end of Coverfly, I'm nervous about it because they did deliver a bunch of entries into our competition, and I hope, I don't know where we're going to make those up. So I'm a little bit nervous about that because our competition is a major revenue source. I won't say it's a major profit center for those thinking that competitions are just cash grabs. No, a screenwriting competition is not a cash grab. So, but it is a way that I try to earn revenue so that I can fund other things that I do to help writers. So I'm not sure what these 127,000 writers are going to do, whether they disappear, whether they float around the universe, whether they latch onto something else. I saw Stage 32 has just popped up with a new version of Coverfly. Not quite sure what's going to happen there. It's an interesting time for screenplay competitions. We're certainly not in the boom period that we were in the 90s and the early O's. It's a struggle. But I will say it is still a crucially important way to get your script noticed, to attract some attention. If you do well in some of the good competitions, which would be Page Awards, Austin, I don't know what's going on with Nichols, but Nichols and me, I would argue, Write LA, you are sending a message to the industry of people who've never heard of you that you don't suck. And that, if it's the right competition, a literary manager is more inclined. We had Sean sit here and say, competitions matter if they're the right ones. So What it's going to do, I don't know. Coverfly was convenient for a lot of ways. It wasn't spectacularly well run. It was a clunky website to deal with.
Well, I feel like when the like my thoughts on screenwriting competitions often are complicated, and that I think that when they are in sort of a pure form, there's a contest, there's valuable prizes, which would be getting your stuff actually read by people.
Yep.
You know, a lot of these, you know, lesser ones will be like, we'll fly to LA. And it's like, well, what does that mean? Like, right. Take that money and make some relationships with reps, because that's what I want. It's what every writer wants, is they're like, I just want to be noticed. I just want to be read. I think I'm good. I just want the people who make these decisions to see me, yes. to hear me, you know, yes. and that's the most frustrating part.
By the way, we just did a survey of writers with Paige and my competition, and 75% of the respondents said all they wanted from a prize was access to the industry.
Exactly. And that's what we're all fighting for. And I think especially in a, you know, internet age, there's so much competition, not necessarily like the level of talent is higher, but there's people. I mean, I think one of your contests had six continents. You had people.
Are there that many? Yeah.
Seven.
Yeah.
This Antarctica. Yeah, no one,
stupid penguins. They're ruining my thing. Yeah, we get entries from all over the world and from all over the United States now too. Actually, yeah. My top 15, I'm about to mail out the prizes. There's only like three of them from California out of the 15.
There's just a lot more, you know, I'd say like noise that you have to break through. And I think, you know, a lot of maybe, I don't want to say older, but more established writers or producers will say, oh, contests, you know, writers specifically, contests, they don't mean anything. And I think maybe they didn't mean as much before, but in an era where there's so much noise, being able to say I placed or I won this thing. Now, having said that, there's also writers I've seen profiles of where they've won like 40 competitions and I haven't heard of any of them.
Yeah.
But my main point about screenwriting competitions is that I think when they're run, you know, for that specific purpose, that works. But I think with something like Coverfly or just other competitions where they're owned by a company that owns a company that owns a company, and it's purely a profit center, not like anyone at the wheel saying, I'm actually sitting here pouring over the top 30, trying to break it down to 15, trying to break it down to 5, trying to break it down to 3. You know, like they're just sort of, there's some unpaid interns that are reading all those things.
Well, they were much more tech friend, heavy too. They were all kind of tech nerds. They weren't writers. And they wanted to figure out algorithms and systems where they could streamline the reading process and the feedback process so that they could earn more revenue and make make it a much more seamless and less hands-on. And that's proven not to be successful. So, which is a positive, I think, in a way, because without the hands-on, you're not getting bang for the buck.
Yeah, and I think a site like Blacklist purports to say we are different than that. We are, you know, we have to have this price because we want to give you an actually vetted industry reader who's going to read your script, give you feedback that you can post on the site. And if enough people like it and like your idea, and I will say I have known producers that have used Blacklist to find log lines, to find projects. Maybe they were a bit lower level of a producer that didn't have the same access to, to, you know, as many, you know, development people or whatever, but they would use that. It is to be seen if that is like, okay, that is the best version of the site. Does that account for like 5% of its use, 1%, 0.01%, 80%? I don't know. I've used it before. It does feel like any system. This is more, I don't know, maybe this is more like a conversation about capitalism.
Yeah, that's the thing. But I was about to say.
Once you reach a certain level.
Yeah.
Can you still sit there and say, oh, I do this for the writer when it's reaching a certain level of profit, and any business that is making money is like, how can it also be sort of charitable or you know, community building? So
yes, welcome to capitalist, mate.
Exactly.
That's the challenge. And people will, I see people slag off on screenplay competitions, like how can they charge so much money? And they're just making a cash grab. And I get personally offended. Because, I am trying to make a profit, but I used to worry about the idea that we would get so big, how would I still manage to keep, like I write all the feedback and I just finished writing 56 sets of notes for the entrance, and which took a while. And We really, all of us involved in this, really want to try to find writers and try to help writers and try to get them going. We charge money for that because it takes up a lot of time. And just think about it. By the time a semifinalist or a top four, top three are picked from my competition, they've been read by four, possibly five different people. Now, I can't have them do that for free. So, and I can't read every script by myself and just say, oh, yeah, I'm going to pick the winner because that's not right. So, this stuff costs money. And then there's marketing involved to try to find these writers, and they don't just find you. So there's a lot involved in screenplay competitions, and it's a challenge. And it is easy to be profit-driven, to flick that switch and be like, wait, if I just don't bother reading them, who's going to care? I'll charge extra money. You know, so there are people out there who do that and take advantage of that. And Coverfly very much came at that position of like, how can we make this, they didn't hate writers, but how can we make this a profit center that also delivers a product in as easy and clinical way as we can?
Well, they gamified it as well with the percentages. You are the top 5% of, you know, female-driven sci-fi, you know, dystopian movies.
Which they know makes a writer feel good. Yeah. A writer can go, hey, mom, I'm the top 5% of female-driven dystopian sci-fi as written in the year 2036. You know, I'm making it somewhere. I'm climbing. So they knew how to make the most of a writer's personality traits and desire to feel like they're moving. And they did all that very well. So it's a tough, I mean, as Felicity said in the last podcast, it's tough right now to try to get noticed and to find your way through the system, but we're still making movies and we're still making TV. So any way you can get noticed is important. Screenplay competitions remain a way to get noticed. And what's kind of nice is that there are less of them now. So it becomes even more, if you do well in the good ones, you actually probably will shine an even brighter light on yourself than you would have 3 or 4 years ago.
All right. Do you want to do another question? Do you want to move on to some movie moments?
We'll do a quick one.
Yeah. This, we can talk quickly about this, but I think there's a lot more to mine, but talking about character intros.
What? Character intros?
Yeah. Just, you know, Tim, age, great hair, you know,
thank you.
What are the, you know, I see some scripts have, you know, they have their, and of every level, giant chunks that kind of describe everything.
Yeah.
Some that say nothing and then describe them sort of throughout the scene.
You know the answer to this question. Do you want to do it? Or do you want me to do it?
Start and then I'll jump in.
short. Here is how I've boiled down after all my years now of doing this. Scene description, and that includes character description, is a game of saying as much as you can with as few words as possible, understanding that all you need to do is ignite the imagination of your reader. You just need to light the match. You don't need to burn the building down. So you need to spark our imagination. Why are you shaking your head?
It's just funny. It's interesting.
Well, because you'll read this thing where it's like, I need to tell you everything about this character. So you'll be instantly bonded with that. And we're reading this being like, I don't need to know 97% of this in this scene. Why do I need to know? And I certainly don't need to know all of their backstory because that's cheating. If all I'm seeing on the screen is a person eating a sandwich, you telling me where they went to school is cheating. So don't do that. So less is more. Absolutely, the fewest words that you can possibly use to ignite our imagination. Don't need to get more specific than that.
Yeah, I think the only way you could say where they went to school is if it's like, you know, Tim eats a sandwich. He's a Yale man through and through. Because I imagine that suggests what shirt you're wearing.
I would argue no. I think that's cheating too. I don't think you should do that. No, because the audience is seeing a dude eating a sandwich. If you wanted to show us that he's eating a sandwich and behind him is his Yale certificate, or he's reading that he just got his thing, or if it's important that he went to Yale, find a way to show us. Don't put it in scene description. That's cheating. Because you're writing this is a movie. We're watching a movie. We're not reading a book. So if you're using the script as a book, you're cheating.
I mean, but would it be cheating to say Tim, you know, age, great hair, sits eating a sandwich. He is upper class through and through. Like, wouldn't that suggest the kind of clothes you're wearing as opposed to saying he's wearing an expensive shirt and a XYZ?
I'd rather the dressed very well, dressed expensively.
But see, that doesn't suggest kind of how you carry yourself, because someone might be dressed.
Exactly.
Yeah, but if I'm trying to let you know that this person is sitting there and they bleed wealth, as opposed to it's someone who doesn't have a lot of money, who is prepared. Like if I were to say Tim age, you know, dressed super well, but clearly has not dressed like this in a while, carries himself like a man who's wearing these clothes for the first time. That to me is something that tells me, and it colors every single line that you say, because you're not pretending to be a guy that's wealthy versus a guy that like carries himself with the ego of being wealthy.
I would vehemently disagree with that because it's your job in the way he carries himself and the way he interacts with other people and the dialogue he says in the scene that we're watching that conveys that information. If you want to have a guy dressed in a suit who's uncomfortable in his suit, you can say he's wearing a suit uncomfortably, and then you move on. And then we're like, why is he wearing it? Is the suit not fit him or whatever? Because then when we see him on screen, we're going to see him like, you know, adjusting his thing, or we're going to do something. We're going to see something visual because we're watching a movie. We're not reading a book. So, and anything you taint us with in a scene, in scene description, that an audience can't be tainted with watching is cheating, and it's avoiding the challenge of screenwriting as opposed to novel writing, which is, Christ, I want in this scene for the audience to understand that he's not used to wearing a suit because he's meeting his daughter who he hasn't seen in 10 years for the first time in this coffee shop, and so he's dressed up for the occasion. But he's got this suit from the op shop. So how do I convey that in a scene? That's my challenge. That's screenwriting. Mm-hmm. Me writing, he's wearing a suit he just got from the op shop. He hasn't worn a suit in 10 years in scene description goes against the entire why are we here for screenwriting. That is absolutely cheating. And I think it's a challenge and a fun challenge to be like, this is what I want to convey. How can I convey it in a way using as few words as possible in scene description, not giving the audience too much information, not giving the reader more information than the audience knows, and telling a story in using visual dialogue action?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I mostly agree in the like, you he got disagree. It from this place, he did this, of course, because there's cheating. And the reason why cheating is bad is not because it's some random rule. It's bad because it doesn't give actual information to the audience. It doesn't actually help the scene.
Well, it's lazy writing. It also conveys a message to the reader that you're lazy.
But versus something that I do think that there is not one way. I've read so much scene description that's either way too, I don't know, like
detailed.
There's literary? Way too cute,
literary,
right?
Yeah,
cute, literary. Where I go, I don't really understand the like even the clauses of how you're phrasing the sentence.
Yes.
And then there's ones that are very trite that are just, you know, there's always like, you know, had a tough life, you know, looks old for her age, or no nonsense is the one I read a lot. It's like they're no nonsense, and it's just like that's a fill in for like this entire character. Not to say that you have to write this long thing, but I think that whatever, to me, it's like a screenplay is both a technical document and also a literary document. It's not the thing that is going to be put on the floor to be shot. It is something that is trying to elicit an emotion for someone. So if I have to be a little literary at times, I'm okay with that. As long as it's getting the job done in the moment that I need the job to be done. Cause I only have two things. I have sight and I have sound, right? So that's all I can do at that moment. So I think that we are mostly saying the same thing.
I would disagree with that, actually. I think now that I think about it, I think you have sight and sound and the audience's past experience in their imagination as well. And I think sometimes we limit ourselves to sight and sound. And I think what you also have is the audience, because you have perceptions, you have expectations, you have an audience who is watching this scene trying to figure out what's going on. And they're filtering it through their own lens. And you have all of those tools as well. And I don't think we use them enough.
I do think, though, that there's something to be said about someone describing an archetype of a character, you know, reading, you know, Goodfellas. I'm not quoting it specifically, but if there's a character who is, you know, he is a guy from the neighborhood, you know, born and raised, like he is the guy that you all know that was born and raised in this neighborhood. And it's like, it's giving you a shorthand for like kind of what this character is like versus saying, well, I only have to just describe what he's wearing and how he like shakes his hand. I might be able to say, this is a guy, you know, born and raised with privilege. Like that to me is something that an actor, for me, it's mostly like what's something that an actor could take and say, I know how to play that. If it's where you went to for breakfast. So an actor can't play where they went to breakfast, but they can play, oh, I was born and raised with complete privilege, silver spoon, money, and all those things.
Sure. I disagree, because I think in the very first scene, you can convey that with the way he carries himself, the way he interacts with other people, and the words he says. I think you can. I think if we had a challenge and you said that, and I wrote a scene conveying those information, and we asked the audience if you could figure out what that guy was by the end of the scene, if they can, they should be able to figure out what you wrote. And if they can't, go back and do a better job.
All right, we'll hash the rest of this off mic. Next time, we'll bring in examples and we'll have a vote.
All right, we got to quickly move on. We have 5 minutes to go. So, movie moment.
Two minutes to go.
Okay, movie moment.
I'll keep mine brief. I watched Memories of Murder the other night. It's a Bong Joon-ho. It's his second movie.
Okay.
It's amazing. It's on Tubi, I think, if anybody wants to watch it. It's free.
Is that the Parasite person?
He did Parasite. Yeah. And basically of the many things that struck me in that movie, he's a brilliant director. It's just the way they frame things. There's a whole story that it's in a frame. It's the camera's not moving. It's just one solid frame. And there's a scene, many scenes where there's three layers of action. There's two guys arguing in the front. There's a guy passed out in the middle of the frame with a woman like brushing his hair. And then there's like a guy trying to hook up with a waitress in the back. And all three planes are on their own movie. And then they all eventually interact with each other. And it's like this entire thing. It's all story forward. It's not just, hey, look at me, I can create a cool frame. It all matters. And it's teaching you about the characters, sort of what we were just talking about. It's teaching you about their behavior without it having to be a close up on his hand doing a thing. It's just happening. And it's also a static shot that is filled with movement, and so you never feel like it's static. So watch that movie. I highly recommend it, and look at how he's doing a lot of these framings of shots and just the layers of action.
What's it called?
Memories of Murder.
Okay. On Tubi.
Tubi. All right. Yeah.
Mine is Lars and the Real Girl.
Mm.
I don't know if I've mentioned it before. I don't think I have. that is an example to me where on the page, that script could have gone in different directions. Basically, it's Ryan Gosling. It's Craig Gillespie directed it, who did a masterful job, because it's one of those scripts where it's about a guy who has mental health issues and he gets a plastic sex doll and treats it like his girlfriend, and everybody in the town decides to take her on as his girlfriend. That could have easily been Sex Farce and been mm-hmm. a totally different movie tonally. What it is a beautiful examination of this guy dealing with some serious worries about his sister-in-law's pregnancy and the way it's manifesting, and it's just beautifully handled. And it's one of those things where you look at if you're worried about a script, you're like, oh, you know, I don't know whether I should write this. This is too stupid or too weird. You look at that film and you're like, I can, as long as I do it in a smart way, I can write any story I want. And finding the right director and finding the right tone it just really shows the collaborative nature of what movies can be, and how any piece of that puzzle in the hands of the wrong person would have sent that thing spiraling off mm-hmm. like Darth Vader at the end of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And it didn't. And so it's a really just a lovely example of all of the pieces of film coming together, I think.
Yeah,
so
it's watch a good movie. That.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want any Aussie trivia?
If you can do it quickly.
Eric Banner. Do you know Eric Banner?
Yeah.
Do you know how he started? You know, he's like a serious actor.
I've watched the clips. Yeah, I forget what's the character's name?
Poyta.
Poyta. Yeah, I've watched some Poyta. I just learned this recently.
He was a comedian. He started on a sketch comedy show called Full Frontal. He was a bartender and he did stand-up comedy and moved into it. So comedy was his whole base. And now he runs screaming from it. So interesting how actors start and where they end up.
And he's very funny.
Yeah,
he's like the most handsome, funny guy. Yeah,
he was super funny. I remember I used to watch Full Frontal. He was super funny. Okay, that's it. That's all we have time for.
Eric Banner.
Eric Banner. ScriptMate is brought to you by Write LA, a screenwriting community. Visit our website to get more tips and helpful information, read articles, watch videos, hear a little less yelling from us, although I do write some blogs that I yell, and book a feedback session with me personally where I don't yell. If you'd like some help with your latest draft or you just want to talk about an idea that's rattling around your head, I'm here for you, and I promise I'm kind. Than I have been today with Tony. Go to write-la.com for all the details. Write-la.com for the details. Our theme music was written and performed by the Australian band The Swarm. Big thanks to them. And our beautiful graphic was designed by one of my two very talented daughters, Claire Schildberger. Thanks for listening. We are grateful. If you have a question you want answered, email me at tim@write-la.com. Tim@write-la.com. We'll be back soon, but for now, say goodbye, Tony.
Goodbye.